Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a novel that, well, really changed the game for narrative. Virginia Woolf's 1925 masterpiece, Mrs. Dalloway.
Oh, absolutely. A classic of high modernism.
It really is. Known for its beautiful, almost poetic prose, but also for diving deep into the human mind, sometimes into pretty dark places.
And Woolf herself, I mean, she was such a central figure, wasn't she? Bloomsbury Group and all that.
Right. And she poured so much of her own understanding, her own struggles with mental health into her writing.
You really feel that intimacy. It's less about plot, much more about consciousness itself.
Yeah.
You're reading thought.
And the setting is so key. We're in London, June 1923. The First World War isn't that far in the past.
Yeah, the shadow of it hangs over everything.
Society's trying to put on this brave, you know, stiff upper lip, Edwardian face.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath, you sense this fragmentation, this trauma. People are just trying to hold it together.
And the genius is how Woolf contrasts that inner turmoil with this deceptively simple structure. The whole book is just one day.
Just one single day. And it kicks off with maybe one of the most famous opening lines in English literature.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that. So ordinary.
Exactly. This simple act, a well-off woman going out to get flowers for her party, it sets off this huge internal journey.
It's not about what she does externally, is it? It's
really
about Clarissa, she's 51, looking back, questioning choices, compromises.
Right. What does it feel like to be alive? That seems to be the core question.
Yeah, and exploring that massive gap between our inner lives, messy, contradictory, and the faces we show the world.
That social mask is just getting by, being functional, somehow a betrayal of something deeper, more authentic.
That's the tension, which leads us right into how she does it, the technique. Mm. Our sources call it the architecture of consciousness.
Yes, because it's not standard storytelling at all. She needed a way to map that inner world. So what's the main tool she's using? That way she slips into their thoughts.
Well, people often call it stream of consciousness, and it is that. But technically, Woolf really mastered what's known as free indirect discourse.
Okay, break that down a bit.
It's this subtle thing the narrator does. It's third person, but suddenly the language, the rhythm, the focus, it all shifts to match the character's inner voice.
Ah, so you're sort of inside their head without quotation marks or he thought, she thought?
Exactly. It's seamless. You're just there thinking along with Clarissa or later with Septimus. It's all fluid, associative, not linear A to B plotting.
Psychological truth over plot points. So you have this tight structure one day.
Right. Unity of time.
But inside their heads, time is all over the place. A smell, a sound can send them back years. How does she keep us grounded in the present day?
Oh, she uses external time almost like punctuation. Interruptions. Think of Big Ben.
The chimes.
Yes. The chimes ring out regularly. Woolf calls them leaden circles dissolving in the air.
Wow. Leaden circles. That's heavy.
It is. It's this relentless, objective clock time, constantly breaking into their subjective, memory-filled inner time. A reminder of mortality, maybe, of the present moment slipping away.
And this technique lets her weave two very different stories together, doesn't it? Clarissa and Septimus.
Absolutely. They're like parallel lives, mirroring each other in some ways, contrasting in others. They never meet, but their experiences feel deeply connected. Two responses to this post-war world.
So let's talk about Clarissa first, the society hostess. What's going on inside her head as she walks through London that morning?
Well, there's anxiety underneath the poise, isn't there? She's thinking about the party, yes, but also about getting older, about choices made long ago, particularly about her youth at Borton.
Borton. That place seems to hold a lot of significance.
It does. It represents youth, freedom, intense emotions, especially her relationship with Peter Walsh and also Sally Seton.
Ah, yes, Peter Walsh, the one she didn't marry. She chose Richard Dalloway instead.
What? Richard offered stability, security, a certain kind of life. Peter was, well, more passionate, more demanding, maybe more difficult. Clarissa seems to be constantly weighing that choice.
And then Peter actually shows up that morning, doesn't he, after years away in India?
Yes. And it throws her completely off balance.
Mm-hmm.
He's still critical, still romantic, still sort of judging her life.
He forces her to confront that path not taken.
Exactly. It brings all those Borton feelings flooding back. That kiss with Sally Seton, too. That moment of intense connection she suppressed.
So her party is the one she put so much effort into. Are they just social obligations?
For Clarissa, they're more. She sees them as her offering, a way to bring people together, create moments of beauty and connection, however fleeting. It's almost a spiritual thing for her.
Okay. Now, at the same time, across London, we have Septimus Warren Smith. His story is much darker.
Much darker. He's a direct casualty of the war, suffering from what we now call severe PTSD, or shell shock, as they termed it then.
He's haunted.
Literally. He sees visions of his friend Evans, who died in the war. His reality is fragmenting. He's desperately trying to hold on to what he calls the integrity of his soul.
Against a world that doesn't understand.
Precisely. A world that just wants him to conform, to get better, to stop making a fuss. And his poor wife, Rezia, this young Italian woman, is completely isolated, trying to navigate this nightmare in a cold, foreign city.
You really feel her desperation. And this brings us to a really poignant moment in Clarissa's day, too, involving her husband, Richard.
Ah, yes. The flowers again.
He wants to tell her he loves her, right?
Sure.
He comes home intending to say it.
He does. But he just can't. The words won't come out. So instead, he gives her roses.
It's quite heartbreaking. What does that say about their relationship?
It captures it perfectly, I think. There's affection, decency, loyalty, but maybe not that deep, soul-bearing intimacy. It's a love expressed through convention, through gestures, not raw emotion. Remember, Clarissa's buying her own flowers earlier.
That contrast. And then Septimus faces his own crisis involving the medical establishment. This feels like Wolfe's sharpest social critique.
Oh, definitely. The appointment with Sir William Bradshaw.
He's a prominent psychiatrist.
Yes, and he represents everything Septimus fears. Cold, rational authority, patriarchy, almost. He doesn't see Septimus's suffering. He sees a lack of proportion.
A lack of proportion. That's chilling.
It is. It's society demanding conformity. Bradshaw wants to fix him, send him away, isolate him, force him to repress his feelings. For Septimus, this treatment is like the death of his soul.
It's an attack on his very being.
Yes. Which leads directly to the tragic climax later that afternoon. Septimus sees another doctor, Dr. Holmes, coming, someone he also distrusts intensely, and he's terrified they're going to take him away.
To Bradshaw's institution.
Right. And in that moment of panic, wanting to escape what he sees as this oppressive human nature, this crushing force.
He makes a final choice.
He jumps out the window onto the railings below. Wolfe presents it not really as surrender, but as a final desperate act of defiance. To preserve himself, his truth, from being extinguished by society.
God, that's devastating. And all this happens while Clarissa is preparing for her party.
Yes. The party is the endpoint, the place where all these threads, public and private, finally gather. Peter's there. Sally Seton's there.
Sally Seton, the girl from Borton.
The very one. Though now she is Lady Rossiter, married, mother of five, quite conventional. Another example, maybe, of youthful rebellion fading.
So the party is underway. Clarissa's kind of mingling, playing the perfect hostess.
Her moment of creation, yes. But then the news arrives.
How?
Sir William Bradshaw and his wife turn up late. And Bradshaw casually mentions, almost as an excuse for being delayed, that one of his patients, Septimus, committed suicide earlier.
He just drops it into conversation at a party.
Just like that. Clinical, detached. And this news hits Clarissa profoundly.
Even though she never knew Septimus. Total stranger.
Exactly. She retreats to a small, quiet room. And suddenly, she feels this intense, almost shocking empathy with him.
What does she understand?
She sees his death not as failure, but as communication, as defiance, an attempt to preserve something precious that the world, represented by Bradshaw, was trying to crush.
Death was defiance.
Yes. Death was an attempt to communicate. She feels he threw his life away, but maybe preserved something essential in doing so. And it makes her think about her own life.
Her compromises, her choice to live, to host parties.
Right. His death makes her value her own life more, perhaps. She chose survival, connection, creating these fleeting moments of beauty. His absolute act somehow clarifies her own path.
It's a moment of deep insight, connecting these two disparate lives through this shared resistance to conformity, maybe.
Absolutely. And it sharpens her critique and Wolfe's critique of that whole unfeeling system. She understands Septimus didn't want to die, but to live just not on society's terms.
So she returns to her party changed.
Renewed is the word Wolfe uses, with a deeper appreciation for the present moment, for the connections she fosters, for life itself, even with its limitations.
So pulling it all together, what are the big takeaways, the core themes you think listeners should really grasp?
Well, first, definitely that struggle between isolation and connection. How hard it is to truly reach another person. Everyone feels quite alone, even Clarissa in her marriage, Peter in his wanderings.
Mm-hmm. And second,
there's a subtle but strong feminist undercurrent, I think. exploring the limited choices for women like Clarissa. Her relationship with Richard, the memory of Sally, it hints at possibilities shut down by convention.
The life she might have lived.
Exactly. And third, obviously, is life and death. Finding meaning in the everyday, the beautiful, the moment Clarissa's way. Contrasted with Septimus seeking an absolute truth, even if it leads to destruction.
Compromise versus purity, almost. It's an incredible balancing act.
It really is. And the ending doesn't offer easy answers, does it?
No, it leaves you with this feeling. It's Peter Walsh again, isn't it? Seeing Clarissa across the room.
Yes. After all the deep thought, the social critique, the narrative fireworks, it comes down to this incredibly intense, almost visceral moment of perception. Peter sees her and thinks.
What is this terror? What is this ecstasy?
It is Clarissa, he said, for there she was. Just the sheer impact of a person's presence. It's mysterious, powerful.
It leaves you pondering, doesn't it? For me, the novel really highlights that so much of life's drama unfolds internally, silently. And finding meaning might just be about choosing to live, choosing to engage, like Clarissa buying the flowers.
That daily choice, that commitment to life, even a flawed one, feels incredibly profound by the end. It's a quiet kind of heroism, maybe. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.